The World is brought to you by Progressive, where customers who save by switching their home and car save nearly $800 on average. Quote at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who save with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
A year ago today, the world was stunned by the killing of George Floyd. Calls for police reform ricocheted across the globe, including in New Zealand.
There was a huge kind of upswelling of popular support for the campaign against armed police patrols that I don't think would have been there if there hadn't been this popular public consciousness.
Also today, Chinese tourists are flocking to the Xinjiang province, where the country stands accused of human rights violations. But that's not on the travel brochure.
It's all purposefully hidden. It's kind of like this Disneyland effect where you go in and you see what is you're meant to see.
I'm Carol Hills, and mining companies in Brazil have had free rein.
Bolsonaro and the government see indigenous territories as up for grabs.
A judge now says they're not up for grabs. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. A year ago today, a Minneapolis police officer placed his knee on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes. Soon, Floyd was dead. The video shocked people around the globe. Floyd's murder became a rallying cry to confront police brutality in communities across the planet, even as far away as New Zealand. Protests there erupted and seemed to have an immediate, tangible impact. But as The World's Roopa Shenoy reports, a year on, it's not clear how much has really changed.
To understand how George Floyd did or did not change New Zealand, you have to go back to before he died, to Christchurch, March 2019.
This afternoon we are dealing with a very serious and tragic series of events.
Police Commissioner Mike Bush confirmed that a white nationalist had shot and killed 51 people at two mosques. New Zealanders were stunned. Many honored the victims by performing the ceremonial Maori haka dance. The country's police force also proposed a drastic step to create armed police units.
It's unusual for New Zealand. We have a nominally unarmed frontline police officers. They are all carrying guns, but they keep them in the car.
Emily Rakate is spokeswoman for People Without Prisons, Aotearoa. It advocates for the abolition of prisons in New Zealand. Her group opposed the proposal, arguing that armed police patrols would end up harassing Maori communities. People from those communities are already disproportionately policed and incarcerated.
About a month before the final decision was made on armed police patrols, George Floyd was murdered.
Thousands protested in New Zealand.
And so there was a huge kind of upswelling of popular support for the campaign against armed police patrols that I don't think would have been there if there hadn't been this popular public consciousness about police racism, about police killings.
And they won. The new police commissioner, Andrew Koster, shelved the proposal.
It's become clear that armed response teams do not align well with the style of policing that New Zealanders expect. As a result, we will not be continuing with them.
Protesters in New Zealand had a strengthened sense of solidarity with others organizing across the world, says Tanya Savisky-Mead. She's director of Just Speak, a group devoted to criminal justice reform.
The level of awareness grew exponentially of the real and immediate fear and stress that armed police puts on communities of colour and Indigenous peoples in New Zealand, but also internationally.
But the coronavirus pandemic slowed the momentum, she says. And in June last year, a New Zealand police officer was shot and killed for the first time in a decade. Officers in mourning performed the haka. Then, days later, a video went viral showing police in Auckland beating a young Maori man who was arrested for graffiti.
Please, look at him. He's f***ing hurt. He's f***ing hurt. Get off him.
In August, an official investigation confirmed that Maori are seven times more likely than white New Zealanders to face use of force by police. Separately, the Independent Police Authority criticized officers for the death of a suspect in custody. And then there was a new issue. Savisky-Mead says officers were caught creating a database of possible suspects without informed consent.
Police were roaming around different communities, just pulling over young people, most often young Māori, and photographing them with no explanation given.
Despite all of that, the New Zealand government is proposing an expansion of police powers to seize firearms. That's in response to a perceived increase in gang activity and shootings.
When we talk about targeting gangs, often what is being said is that is targeting Māori, even if people obviously won't say that out loud.
Still, Savisky Mead says she's hopeful that George Floyd's death and the ensuing protests in New Zealand will help bring more accountability. Police have announced a long-term research project to uncover biases in their policies and procedures.
An inquiry is unlikely to tell us anything that we don't already know, but I think the degree to which police are participating in that process is an important change from where they were 2 years ago, which was basically denying the existence of racism within the force.
Emily Rakete of People Without Prisons Aotearoa is more skeptical. She points to a pattern on policing and racism that goes back to the 1980s.
So they apologised to us for being racist then, and they said that they'd get better, and then they did another report that found that they were being racist. So they apologised to us and said that they would get better, and they did another report that found that they were being racist. So they apologised to us and said that they would get better. They're doing another report now. I'm really, really interested to hear what it finds. I think that it might find that they're racist, in which case they will no doubt apologise to us and say that they're going to get better.
For people in New Zealand, Rakete says, George Floyd's death was an awakening. But that's just a beginning. There's a long way to go. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Tomorrow, we continue our examination of global issues in policing with a look at France, where Black and Arab men are 20 times more likely to be stopped randomly by authorities, and where videotaping the police is a legal debate. That's tomorrow on The World. The U.S. and Iran are expected to resume talks this week, haggling through intermediaries over a return to the Iran nuclear deal. Large gaps remain on both sides. Barbara Slavin has been following all of this. She directs the Future of Iran initiative at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Barbara, why are the two sides still so far apart after four rounds of negotiations?
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is the fact that it is a little bit more difficult to get back into this agreement than many of us had hoped or anticipated. Sanctions that were put on by the Trump administration, many layers of them using different authorities. It takes a little while to figure out how to unravel them and which ones absolutely have to be removed for the United States to truly be in compliance with the deal again. On the Iranian side, I think it's domestic politics. They're about to have presidential elections, and even though there doesn't seem to be that much suspense about them, still, there seems to be an effort to postpone any kind of a breakthrough until just before the elections or just after the elections so that the outgoing Rouhani government doesn't get any credit for a resumption of this deal and the lifting of sanctions.
So are you suggesting that Iran does not want to seal a deal while Rouhani is still president?
I think that there are individuals within that system that don't want Rouhani to get any kind of credit for the lifting of sanctions. Yes, the elections that are coming up are really not so much about who's president, but about who succeeds the supreme leader of the country, Ayatollah Khamenei, and whether the more conservative factions, which are rather hostile to the West, whether they can consolidate all power in the Islamic Republic before Khamenei passes from the scene. And so the idea that the benefits of a resumption of the JCPOA wouldn't begin to be seen until after the presidential elections, I think, is appealing to some of the most powerful factions in Iran, frankly.
And the JCPOA, of course, is the initials for the Iran nuclear deal. What do you see the U.S. and Iran potentially making concessions about in order to get to a deal?
Well, the United States has gone through the list of 1,500 new sanctions put on Iran by Donald Trump and decided which ones absolutely have to be removed. So it took a while to sift through all of this. They're going to have to figure out the legal authorities needed to unravel these sanctions. And then on the Iranian side, of course, the Iranians have made enormous strides in their nuclear program since the Trump administration quit the deal. And so how do you get Iran back into compliance? How many centrifuges have to be removed? The main goal is to get Iran back to a situation where it's at least a year from being able to make enough fissile material for a single nuclear weapon.
I'm wondering how Israel factors into this. As you know, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting Israel right now. What do you think he might be saying to the Israelis to convince them that reviving the Iran nuclear deal is a good idea?
Well, I don't think Israel is in any position to object to this at this point, after what we've just seen happen in Gaza and in Israel proper. I think Israel has much more serious threats internally and in the occupied territories than are represented by Iran. So I don't think that Bibi Netanyahu is in a position to put any demands on the Biden administration over Iran. Clearly, Netanyahu will continue to state his opposition to a U.S. return to the deal. But right now, I think he needs U.S. goodwill as Israel faces issues, much more pressing issues with the Palestinians.
Barbara Slavin is the director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot, Barbara.
You are quite welcome.
In the West African state of Mali, the military has once again seized control of the government. The country's president, prime minister, and defense minister were all reportedly detained on Monday, and now military officers are in charge. This comes at a fragile moment for Mali, where a military coup took place last August. The international community is strongly condemning what's playing out right now. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gakandi, is following the story. Halima, why did the military suddenly arrest the president and prime minister in Mali?
Well, at first that wasn't clear until really today when we saw a statement from Assimi Goïta, who's a military leader and currently the vice president of Mali. And he said that the president, Bandao, who is currently Mali's head of state, and the prime minister, Mokhtar Ouane, had violated the terms of this transitional government agreement or charter that was established last year after the military coup that saw the resignation of the former president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. And according to this transitional agreement, the country is supposed to be led by a joint civilian and military government that's supposed to lead the country to have open elections next year. But on Monday, according to Goïta, the president and the prime minister reshuffled the government and replaced some of the coup leaders who were occupying defense and security positions. And according to Goïta, according to the military, they weren't consulted on that decision. And so they've said that has been a major violation of the charter. And that's the reason why these leaders were arrested.
What is the situation with this military guy, Goïta? He leads a coup, he sets up a transitional process, then doesn't like it, and then is essentially kind of doing another coup, isn't he?
I mean, that's exactly what's happening. Goïta was one of the military leaders responsible for the coup last year. Now he, in this transition government, is the vice president. And in his role, he is in charge of the defense, security, and kind of state reform issues, but he has no mandate at all for essentially staging the second coup that Mali has seen in less than a year. He's somebody who in the past has received training from the U.S. military as well as other countries. And internally within Mali, at least last year, he and the military did receive a good amount of support from Malians who at the time were protesting, wanted to see the president, former president, out of power. So he's been able to portray this in the past as the military supporting the will of Malians. But the question remains how this move will be viewed this time around.
Well, what has the response been from the international community to all this? I mean, including Mali's neighbors.
We've heard condemnation from the United Nations, from the African Union, from the U.S., from the European Union. They've all condemned military leaders and called on the president, prime minister, and others who have been arrested to be released immediately. And in a joint statement, they even warned that these actions from the military could impact the support that the international community gives to Mali. And more directly today, we saw the French president, Emmanuel Macron, threaten targeted sanctions based on what happened today. But in terms of what happens next, West African leaders from ECOWAS, which is the Economic Community of West African States, did arrive in Mali today to see if there's a way out of the crisis.
The World's Halima Gakandi. Thanks a lot, Halima.
Thank you, Carol.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Over the last 48 hours, Belarus has been making headlines across the globe. You may have heard about the commercial airliner heading from Greece to Lithuania that was intercepted over Belarus. It was forced to land in Minsk, and a young dissident was removed and detained upon the orders of the Belarusian president. 26-year-old Roman Protasevich is now under arrest. Franek Wieczorka is following this case closely. He's a senior advisor to the leader of the Belarusian opposition, Svetlana Tianovskaya, and he spoke with me from exile in Vilnius, Lithuania.
Honestly, I was shocked. I was shocked because he's a good friend of mine. We were in touch basically every day, and a few hours before he boarded the plane, we just chatted, and he said, "Oh, Franek, I see that someone is following me." So basically, he informed us about possible agents, and back then we didn't think it's true. We thought perhaps Roman is a bit paranoid, but a few hours later, I saw the news and I saw that this plane was turned to Minsk, and you know, back then I knew, I already understood that this happened because of Roman. The real target of this special operation was Roman.
And you spoke to him actually before he boarded, and that's where he was noticing those people who appeared to be agents who were following him.
Yeah. And, you know, later we found out, as the management of Ryanair informed, that KGB people, they were following Roman. They were on the same plane. And when the plane was boarded in Minsk, they left. So the airplane continued after 5 hours in Minsk, continued its flight. And without Roman, his girlfriend, and those KGB agents.
About 24 hours after he was removed from that plane, Protasevich appeared in a video. Possibly under duress, he confessed to organizing mass protests against the Belarusian regime. What's your reaction to this video?
This video is horrific. Perhaps he was tortured after 24 hours after his detention. He appeared on this video confessing in everything and saying that I'm in the detention center, nothing is happening, the attitude is good. So it reminded me of the Soviet era when in Stalin time, KGB people were arresting people, detaining people, and forcing them to confess in the cruelest and the toughest crimes. Unfortunately, we must say that Belarusian KGB and Belarusian regime is one of the harshest in Europe and harshest in decades that Europe has seen.
Franek, what do we know about Roman Protasevich's current condition?
We don't know much. The only thing we knew is from the Telegram channel of the Lukashenko's propaganda. I'm sure he is in the detention center. He is in a prison cell, perhaps solitary cell. Usually they keep the detainees isolated during the first days or during the interrogation stage. They're trying to get so much information as possible. They're trying to get access to his accounts, to his social media. They're trying also to put pressure on him. When the person is detained, he or she is always stressed, and this is the very good moment to put pressure and to break this person. It doesn't matter how strong you are. They have enough methods, psychological and physical, to force you to do what they want.
Franek, you work with Svetlana Tianovskaya, the leader of the Belarusian opposition. Do these events from the last couple of days change anything for you and your team?
It extremely changed. That everything changed. You know, before we felt quite safe being in exile in Vilnius and Warsaw, but now we realize that we are followed everywhere. And if these people who were following Roman in Athens, if it's true, it means that they could follow us in Lithuania, in Paris, in Berlin. So it's not only about the airplane. It's not only about this incident. It's about character of the regime. When before it was the domestic political crisis, now it's the threat to the entire Europe, and European leaders, Western leaders, must take it very seriously.
What do you make so far of the EU's response to this event?
We spoke to Josep Borrell. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya had a call with ministers of foreign affairs of Ireland, Greece, Poland, France, also with the National Security Advisor of the United States of America. EU is paradoxically very quick and very strong. And personally, I did not expect such quick reaction. They decided to adopt sanctions. They decided to close the Belarusian airspace. They decided to isolate regime politically. I think even Lukashenko, when he was doing this, he expected zero reaction. But this strong response, it gives me hope that the Belarusians will not be abandoned.
But doesn't the steps the EU has taken, sanctions, possible flight ban, and airlines not flying over Belarus, doesn't that further isolate regular Belarusian people and not necessarily affect Lukashenko or his regime?
You know, fly ban, it's not about sanctions. Fly ban, it's about security, about safety. We understand European nations who prohibit flying over Belarus because it put in danger European citizens. We had the flight flying from Athens to Vilnius, from one European capital to another one. So it's not the domestic problem. And this reaction by international organizations is very, very fair and predictable. But it's not enough. We should understand that this event, it's the part of many other events that happened before. A few days ago, political prisoner Svitolij Ashurak died in prison from heart attack, but we believe he was murdered. 1 week ago, Belarusian portal Tut.by, which covers 40% of Belarus population, was attacked and 20 journalists arrested. Altogether, more than 30 reporters are in jail right now. So we see the consequence of events, and this situation with the airplane, it's one of many moments. We just ignored these calls before. The world opened eyes and realized how horrible this regime is.
Franek, you've said in recent days that last week, Tianovskaya herself was on that same flight route from Athens to Vilnius, Lithuania on Ryanair. If an arrest like this can happen to Roman Protasevich, can't it happen to you or Tianovskaya?
Yes, yes, I could be now in the KGB on the interrogation. Tikhanovskaya will be in the same prison or somewhere else. We fly the same flight over Belarus, and we actually discussed, is it possible that our flight can be captured by Belarusians or the plane can be landed on the territory of Belarus? And, you know, and we thought, oh, no, it's unrealistic. It's impossible. The probability is almost zero. And suddenly, a few days after this happened, it's shocking.
So how are you going to change your tactics, your approach to being in the opposition, if something like this is possible?
Well, we have to be cautious. We have to be more creative. We have to think about our security, and we have to protect our people. We should understand that the threat is coming not only for people who are in Belarus, but also for those in exile. We should create our own security. We work with BIPOL. This is the organization of officers who defected from Lukashenko's institutions, police and investigative committee. And we will be consulting with them how to become better, because we are dealing with a very tough secret service of one of the harshest regimes in Europe.
Franek Viachorka is a senior advisor to Svetlana Tianovskaya, the leader of the Belarusian political opposition. He's been speaking to us from exile in Vilnius, Lithuania. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the Middle East. The diplomatic trip follows a deadly war between Israel and Hamas. Blinken is meeting with top officials and has vowed U.S. aid to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Read more about the latest from the region in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. After nearly 4 months in detention, Myanmar's political leader Aung San Suu Kyi finally met with her lawyer in person. He says his client had no idea just how big Myanmar's resistance had become.
She said she was given only government-issued newspapers, only government television.
That story coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. This travel season, Chinese tourists who can't go to Paris or New York are choosing stateside destinations. One that's growing in popularity, Xinjiang, the region where Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities have been subject to what human rights advocates say is widespread abuse. That's an outside view. Inside China, online searches for Xinjiang tourism have taken off. The region has become one of China's hottest destinations. The World's Rebecca Canther reports from Xinjiang.
Tianshi, or Heavenly Lake, is a beautiful alpine spot about 2 hours from Urumqi, the capital of Xinjiang. Think Swiss Alps. I'm on a crowded tour bus that climbs up winding mountain roads to get to the lake. And who's on the bus? Chinese retirees. Lots of them. Also, couples, tour groups, and old friends wearing matching outfits. Once off the bus, a tour guide wearing a headset gathers her group around her for a quick introduction. Then everyone makes a beeline for the shore of the still frozen lake for the main attraction, selfies. One woman wears an ethnic Uyghur costume she purchased at a tourist kiosk. Another woman is shooting a short dance video to post on Douyin, China's TikTok. After posing with my fellow travelers, as a rare foreigner, I'm also an attraction here, they have plenty of advice for me. Ms. Shao lives in Urumqi and has come to the lake with her workmates. She says I should head to southern Xinjiang to experience the traditional ethnic minority cultures the area is known for. When I ask about travel safety, she points behind me. See that police box, she says. In Xinjiang, there's one every 300 or 400 meters, so it's very safe. If you call the police, they arrive in 1 minute. Otherwise, they're fired, she says. Security is important to tourism in this region, where mistrust between Uyghurs and the Han Chinese has sometimes led to violence. Deadly riots in 2009 were followed by a harsh government crackdown. Tourism took a huge hit. In 2014, after more violence, China began its Strike Hard campaign, investing heavily in cameras, metal detectors, police checkpoints. Then in 2017, it began forcing Muslim minorities, mostly Uyghurs and ethnic Kazakhs, into political re-education camps. It's estimated that 1 million have been detained. Nuri Trakel, a Uyghur American lawyer and activist, described the camps at the Oslo Freedom Forum in 2019.
These camps put Uyghurs through conversion therapy. Camp survivors said that they've been forced to study Xi Jinping ideology and to denounce their religion. Those don't follow the rules suffer physical torture.
Of course, none of this would be visible to a tourist. And with intense security measures now in place, vacationers are flooding in. On Chinese TikTok, videos like this one entice tourists with images of jeep caravans, camel rides on sand dunes, and plates of cumin-spiced lamb kebabs. They promise an exotic vacation on the old Silk Road, with different cultures, languages, and foods. Best of all, you don't even need a visa. At the Flaming Mountains, tour groups are posing with a statue of the Monkey King, a character from a classic Chinese novel and TV show that was filmed here. Miss Yu and her friend are just two of the many tourists who have traveled across the country to experience the region. We saw a lot of recommendations for Xinjiang on the internet, so we wanted to come and see it ourselves, she says. But what exactly are tourists like Miss Yu seeing? Josh Summers lived in Xinjiang as a travel writer for more than a decade. He says he used to get on his motorcycle and ride off to explore remote areas. By the time he left in 2018, that was no longer possible.
You're herded to the places where you're allowed to go, and you can't explore beyond that very easily, at least, without somebody tailing you or asking you why you're going off the beaten path or why you're heading in that direction.
Even when he was living there, he wasn't able to see the full scale of the repression of Uyghurs, he says. He only heard about it in whispers from close friends.
It's kind of like this Disneyland effect where you go in and you see what is you're meant to see. But what you don't realize is there's this whole backside and you don't get to see. But the reality is so much different.
At a tourist spot in Urumqi, Uyghur dancers perform on an outdoor stage. The tourism industry promotes the region through performances like this. Professor Rachel Harris is an ethnomusicologist who studies Uyghur music and culture at SOAS at the University of London. She says these public performances mask a crackdown on the very culture they appear to celebrate.
You wouldn't be able to see inside people's homes, so you wouldn't be aware of the kind of surveillance that's going on in that way. You wouldn't be able to see the things which, of course, are not happening. So community gatherings, so plenty of singing and dancing for the tourists, but definitely no community festivities of your own.
Human rights advocates worry about the impact of rising tourism in Xinjiang. Nuri Trakel, the Uyghur American lawyer, once worked as a tour guide in his hometown of Kashgar.
China has been very, very aggressive in its disinformation campaign, trying to portray a happy look. They're also trying to tell the world that the Uyghurs' homeland is beautiful, therefore there's no genocide.
Sophie Richardson, a China expert at Human Rights Watch, agrees that tourism in Xinjiang helps advance Beijing's agenda.
The push for tourism from the rest of the country will really only serve to strengthen the government's narrative about the region, but also create an additional group of people who will say, everything is fine. Look at all the happy minorities. The policies are working well. It's safe to visit.
Back at Heavenly Lake, workers are getting ready for the influx of visitors eager to check Xinjiang off their bucket list. Walkways are being widened, ticket line barriers extended. A new guest house is under construction. More than 200 million tourists will travel to Xinjiang this year, and that number is expected to double by 2025. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther, Urumqi, Xinjiang.
Is France on the brink of a civil war? That's what a group of retired generals claim in a controversial letter published by a far-right magazine, but some analysts are skeptical and say it's a ploy for political gain in next year's elections. Rebecca Rossman has our story from Paris.
The hour is grave. France is in peril. That's the start of the letter signed by 20 retired generals who argue France is in a state of disintegration and the state's failure to act against the, quote, suburban hordes will scorn the country and lead to the death of thousands. By suburban hordes, the authors meant predominantly Muslim immigrant communities. If nothing is done, they say they may take matters into their own hands to protect our civilization's values. In large, it was cast off as an outlandish stunt filled with baseless claims not even worthy of a reaction from the political mainstream. That is, until the far right saw an opportunity. In a written response, far-right leader Marine Le Pen urged the generals to, quote, join her in the battle for France. I can say that I share their concern. I share their assessment, Le Pen told French television, though she stopped short of endorsing the general's threat of a coup. I think this problem is fixed through politics, by a project backed by the French people in a democratic context. It's no secret what she was hinting at. The upcoming 2022 presidential elections, where crime, terrorism, and radical Islam have already taken center stage. A second letter was published earlier this month, this time by a group of anonymous soldiers who said they supported the general's claims. It's created a tough balancing act for President Emmanuel Macron's centrist party, which has been accused of pandering to the right recently to gain more votes from traditional conservatives.
Ce pourrait donc être une affaire insignifiante.
Several days after Le Pen's comments, French Prime Minister Jean Castex publicly condemned the letter, casting it off as something that, quote, would have been insignificant if it wasn't for Le Pen's political maneuvering. The French Minister of Armed Forces also said those who signed it would be sanctioned for violating a law that bars them from expressing opinions publicly. But some say Macron's government acted too late. Reem Sarah Alouane is a researcher in comparative law at the University of Toulouse.
The Minister of Defense eventually came out, I think, 4 or 5 days afterwards, which is quite a long time for such a sedition letter. And my fear is that it gives even more legitimacy to Marine Le Pen to be elected. And I firmly believe that after this, her chances increased by 200%.
A survey released shortly after the letter went viral found that an astonishing 58% of people supported it, though some analysts questioned the survey's methodology. Jean-Yves Camus is a Paris-based political scientist studying the far right. He doesn't doubt that for most people, crime and terrorism are pressing issues.
But does that really mean that they agree to the fact that tomorrow the army could go to the streets and seize power and stage a coup? No, I do not believe that.
But civil war was never the real threat, says Reem Sarah Alouane.
Don't take seriously those old army guys who basically are just regretting a past that does not exist anymore. But take seriously the impact that it has on politics as well as on people who don't know any better because they fear that the country isn't a threat because of migrants, refugees, Muslims, or name it, really.
We've seen far-right candidates rise to power in this exact way before, she says, from Hungary to Austria and even the United States. If Macron doesn't do more to counter these claims head-on, his party may be in for a rude awakening next year. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
A big win for indigenous communities in Brazil. For years, unlawful miners have invaded Yanomami lands in northern Brazil, sometimes violently attacking indigenous people. Yesterday, a Brazilian Supreme Court judge ordered Brazil's government to remove the miners. Michael Fox has our story.
Earlier this month, this video of illegal miners shooting at unarmed residents of a Yanomami village in northern Brazil went viral over Twitter. A group of indigenous women in brightly colored shirts line a hillside. Suddenly, shots are fired from a speedboat rushing by on the river below. The women run, carrying babies and pulling along small children. They race off camera toward the trees. According to reports, three people were injured. Two children would die, drowned during the confusion. Out of fear, many slept in the forest, catching pneumonia. Attacks like this have rippled on for days. It's part of a years-long trend. According to a recent report, mining on Yanomami territory grew by 30% in 2020, with nearly 6,000 acres of land deforested. Images of mining areas there show a wasteland of cleared forest and contaminated pits. Many blame the government of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro for encouraging illegal mining in the Amazon. When federal police investigated this month's attack on the Yanomami village, they also came under fire and responded with their own shots.
Estamos muito tristes, tá? Estamos revoltados também pelos bandidos.
We are very sad. We are angry, says village leader Tomoteo Palimiteri in this video shared by the media outlet Amazonia Real. He holds a spear and stands in front of a group of village warriors at the banks of the river. The miners are attacking us day and night, he says. We just want to live in peace. Roughly 29,000 Yanomami and Yekwana people live in Yanomami land in northern Brazil, near the border with Venezuela. It's the largest indigenous territory in the country, but it's under attack. Dario Copenawa is the vice president of the Utucara Association, which represents more than 370 Yanomami and Yekwana communities there.
Mais de 20 mil garimpeiros, eles estão na presença do território hoje em dia.
He says, in our territory, there are more than 20,000 miners today. This is a threat to the life of the forest, a threat to the lives of people who live in their villages, children, women, and elderly. Mining kills. It murders people. It destroys the life of Mother Earth. When I spoke with Copenawa last year, he had just met with Brazilian Vice President Hamilton Mourão to demand that the miners be removed from their territory. The Yanomami had launched a petition and an international campaign. The Supreme Court had even ordered the government to create a plan of action. 10 months later, nothing has been done. Fiona Watson is the research director of Survival International, a UK-based NGO that works with indigenous communities in Brazil.
The worrying thing that goes along with this wildcat mining, you know, apart from all the social and environmental impacts on indigenous peoples, like the way they bring in diseases like COVID-19 or malaria, is also the contamination that comes with it. So there are very high levels of mercury pollution. And this is like a silent killer disease because it's not obvious.
Last week, the Yanomami, together with Brazil's largest indigenous organization, APIB, formally requested that the Supreme Court force the Brazilian government to finally remove illegal miners from 7 indigenous territories, including the Yanomami. Samara Patachó is an indigenous legal advisor to the group, who spoke at a press conference held online last week.
E aí o governo ainda não apresentou essas medidas concretas, e por isso que a gente volta a bater nessa tecla de que
she
é necessário.
She said the government has still not delivered concrete measures. And that is why we are again demanding that it is necessary to use all of the state apparatus, the Environmental Protection Agency, police, and everyone, to remove the miners. Community leaders say the situation is dire.
Já chega de genocídio, já chega de matança, e quem protege o meio ambiente são os povos indígenas.
Enough of the genocide, enough of the massacre, said Alessandra Munduruku during the press conference. She's a leader of the Munduruku people, whose land near the Tapajós River has also been devastated by illegal mining in recent years. Enough of destroying our rivers and killing our forests, she said. You need to leave. The Supreme Court needs to do something urgently.
On Monday, it did. Brazil's Supreme Court responded to the request from native groups and ordered the federal government to adopt immediate measures to protect indigenous lives and remove illegal miners from Yanomami and Munduruku territories within 90 days. This is no small task, and it's still unclear how the government will respond, as President Jair Bolsonaro has been working to open up protected land. Here's Fiona Watson from Survival International.
Bolsonaro and the government see indigenous territories as up for grabs, and the agribusiness sector, the mining sector, the logging sector, all these big economic powerhouses, if you like, in Brazil are eyeing up indigenous lands.
Native peoples say they will fight to defend their land and their way of life. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
For the first time in nearly 4 months, the leader of Myanmar's ousted government was seen in person. Aung San Suu Kyi appeared briefly in court yesterday. Many of Myanmar's political leaders were jailed after a military coup in February. Suu Kyi now faces a raft of charges that could leave her imprisoned for life. The United Nations says those charges are politically motivated. Yesterday, Suu Kyi was allowed to meet with her legal team for the first time since February, including our next guest, attorney Kin Mong Jaw. I asked him what he learned in his meeting with his client.
She seems to be fit, but a little thinner than usual.
So a little thinner than usual. What about emotionally? How is she doing emotionally?
She seems as composed as ever. She don't seem to be depressed, or she don't seem to be very excited. She seems as smart as ever, as in the past.
Does she seem to know what's going on in the country of Myanmar? I mean, do you have the sense that she is able to listen to the news and listen to what's going on in house arrest or not?
We asked her about that. She said she was given only government-issued newspapers, government-issued journals. Only government television channels were accessible to her, yeah.
Does she seem to know that Myanmar's military has been cracking down on pro-democracy protesters and that more than 800 people have died? Was she aware of that?
Yesterday, she didn't know exactly about that.
Has she been under house arrest at her home or in different locations? Is that clear?
She said she was shifted the other night to a new place, and she didn't know the whereabouts of the new place. She asked us, lawyers, the location of this place.
So she was transferred somewhere else the other night, and she's not sure where she was transferred. Is it possible for her to get a fair trial in Myanmar?
That question is very difficult for us to answer, because as lawyers, Myanmar lawyers, we have duty to trust our judiciary. But it was difficult for us to be regarded as officially appointed lawyers of Aung San Suu Kyi. We didn't have any access to her. We didn't have any contact with her to discuss about the case. Only yesterday, we have one chance to meet with her in person and to discuss about the case and to get her instructions. So it's hard to tell that the case will be fair trial.
Before the coup, Suu Kyi's international reputation was damaged by her actions against the Muslim minority in Myanmar. How do you reconcile her role in perpetuating that human rights situation with this new situation in which she is herself being persecuted?
Yes. Whatever she stands on those issues, she remains the symbol of democracy in the country. And the people have voted for her, so I have to stand for her. That's my position.
Kin Mong Jaw is one of the lawyers for detained former leader Aung San Suu Kyi. He met with her in person today for the first time. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
It's not unusual for artists to stand up for a cause. Their platform is their power. The cause for the musical collective Yatsin is indigenous rights. Their debut album is called Indian Yard. On this track, the song is sung in Yupik, an indigenous language spoken in Alaska and eastern Russia. Nicholas Galanin and Otis Calvin III are two members of the band. Otis joined us from Phoenix. Nicholas was in Palm Springs, but is usually based in Sitka, Alaska. As the creative force behind Yatsin, Nicholas started things off by telling us what Back in That Time is all about.
The language translates to English to "the time is now, to my people I come before you." My cousin once said to me to follow her dance as I sing my song, "Up a pond for all our people." This is a reference to the power of our songs, the power of our community. We're out here every day fighting for basic human rights, land rights, water rights, and to me, this acknowledges the power of our songs.
Otis, the collective is called Yatsin. What's your role in the band?
I don't think anybody has a role in Yatsin, to be honest with you, because so many people are involved. I'd go to Alaska a lot. When we're up there, all we do is just make music, hang out, fish, run. Nikki's always working on a totem pole or a canoe or something mind-blowing. And then we collaborate over the internet when we're not together. It's just kind of a constant, unending flow. It's been going on for a long time. Started out as a fan for sure of Nikki's music, and was important to me to be diligent about not only like collaborating with him, but actually making something that would come to fruition and be real, because I thought that what he was doing musically was different than anything I'd ever heard for sure.
What was different about it?
Most of the indigenous music I'd heard would be usually traditional. It was very difficult to find things that weren't a certain type of sound. Even art-wise, he opened up my world to a lot of things, and he doesn't have any restrictions. He's just very free.
Nicholas, I want to ask you about an art installation project you did. It was 45-foot high letters that spelled Indian land. It's a reference to the big Hollywood sign in L.A. What inspired you to do it?
Yeah, this work was installed for the Desert X Biennial on Agua Caliente, Cuyia land, Palm Springs. One initial aspect of it is how Hollywood as an institution has helped perpetuate romanticized stereotypes towards indigenous communities. The work acknowledges that indigenous communities have over 15,000 plus years of deep connection and understanding, and have cared for these places all these times, and that everybody will benefit in these communities with that care and knowledge.
Nicholas Galanin of the musical collective Yatsin. We also heard from musician Otis Calvin III. The group's debut album is Indian Yard. World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.